In the last or the previous meditation, Jesus is condemned to death and begins his journey to Calvary. And in chapter 27, verse 32, Matthew continues, "As they went out, they came upon a man from Cyrene," it's North Africa, "named Simon. They compelled this man to carry Jesus' cross." Just an interesting element of that that is not that obvious here, but if you read Mark's Gospel, probably written in Rome, he actually says, he says Simon, and then he says he's the father of Alexander and Rufus. So obviously two people who are known in the Roman community, but not that relevant over in Antioch. So Mark links this Simon to the two men in the Roman Christian community. Jesus said once, "If you want to be my disciple, you must deny yourself, take up your cross, and come with me." Simon was reluctant, but it seems that he became a disciple. For Paul, in his letter to the Christian community in Rome, writes, among other things, "Greet Rufus." It's no certainty, but it's highly likely it's the same Rufus that Mark says was the son of Simon of Cyrene. "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and greet his mother, who was a mother to me also," says Paul. The gratitude and love shown him by Jesus must have changed Simon's heart so that he came to see his task as a privilege, and it brought about his conversion. If Jesus needed someone to help him carry his cross, just a reflection, we shouldn't be surprised if we find it too hard to carry our cross alone. In our case, some of the crosses are the result of our own folly and sin. Sometimes, however, like Jesus, we find ourselves weighed down with crosses that have been laid upon us unjustly by others who may or may not know what they're doing. And Matthew continues, "When they came to a place called Golgotha," and he explains that means the place of the skull, "they offered him wine to drink, mixed with gall," an allusion back to Psalm 69. "But when he tasted it, he wouldn't drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his clothes." "They divided his clothes among themselves," another allusion back to Psalm 22, "by casting lots. Then they sat down there and kept watch over him." There's the psalm. "They divide my clothes among themselves, and for my robe they cast lots." Over his head, they put the charge against him, and this was normal practice. It read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." The Latin for that, which you may know, is Jesus, Nazarenus Rex Judaeorum, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. And if you look at the first letters, I-N-R-I, that's often put on that little indication at the top of the cross, the reason why Jesus was murdered. A reflection this time from a Hans Urs von Balthasar. He writes, "How can we be so blind and so callous as to nail to a cross hands that have only ever been raised in blessing, hands that have touched our eyes to bring sight, our arms that we have embraced in order to bring healing and comfort? How can we ever think of nailing to a cross feet that have walked with us on our journey, encouraging us, bringing us hope by liberating us from the fears that can so easily trap us? What this body makes visible is the twisted shape of hearts, created for love, chosen for love, that yet offer every insult to love, attempt every abuse of its secret and holy nakedness. Jesus' whole body shouts shame, has become the utter shame of mankind." Matthew continues, "Two bandits were crucified with Jesus, one on the right and one on the left. Those who passed by derided Jesus, shaking their heads and saying, 'You would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days. Save yourself. If you're the Son of God," we're back to the trials back in chapter 3 of the Gospel in the desert, "if you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." How amazingly blind we can become. See what the crowd are saying. They're told to say it, of course, and that's the rumour that's getting around. They're asking Jesus, "Save yourself." And we've read a number of times, twice already here, and it's in all the Gospels, Jesus says, if you want to save yourself, you'll lose it. He's not going to save himself. That's not anyone's life. It's never about that. It's about giving self. It's about love. But they can't see that. So they're saying to Jesus, "Save yourself." Something you can't even imagine Jesus doing. In the same way, we're told, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and elders, were mocking Jesus, saying, "He saved others, he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Well, let him come down from the cross now and we'll believe in him. He trusts in God. Well, let God deliver him if he wants to. For he said, 'I am God's son.'" The bandits who were crucified with Jesus also taunted him in the same way. We're not talking about Luke, but you do know Luke well, I'm sure. And in Luke, one of them isn't taunting Jesus, and he asks him, "Go into your kingdom." But Matthew doesn't know that story, or doesn't. Yes, he he probably just doesn't know it. It's not part of his community tradition. And so here we have, just in general, they're both joining everybody else in taunting Jesus. He's totally alone. From noon on, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. They're counting from sunrise, of course. So the third hour is 9 o'clock in the morning. They don't have clocks, so mid-morning. And then the sixth hour is when the sun's above. And the ninth hour is when the sun is halfway down to the horizon. And at the ninth hour, in our terms, 3 p.m., if you like, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani." That's actually Hebrew. And El, you probably know already, means God. Eli is my God, E on the end. And then the rest, "Why have you abandoned me or forsaken me?" Once again, Mark is quite interesting because he has Jesus say that in Aramaic, which is Jesus' own language, his mother tongue. "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani." It's very similar, of course, because Hebrew and Aramaic, the lettering, etc. The Semitic. My God, why have you forsaken me?" We'll come back to that. Text goes on. "When some of the bystanders heard it, they said, 'He's calling on Elijah.'" Well, it's not that obvious why they thought that. It will become obvious to us in a moment. But just looking at it, what's it got to do with, he's saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? What's that got to do with calling on Elijah? "At once, one of them ran and got a sponge, filled it with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to Jesus to drink. But the others said, 'Wait, let's see whether Elijah will come to save him.' Then Jesus cried again with a loud voice," and we're not given the words, "and he handed over his spirit to God and to us, to the world. He gave up his spirit." Spirit and breath, it's the same word. So he breathed his last, would be a quite adequate translation, but there's more to it than that. It's a giving of the spirit. Amos chapter 8, verse 9 writes, "On that day," and this is all part of the poetry and music and memory that they're trying to get to the meaning of what was going on Calvary. That's what they all try to do. And so here's Amos that says, "On that day, the sun will set at midday, and the light will grow dark upon the land at daytime." And hence the first verse, "From noon on, from midday on, darkness came over the whole land until for the first half of the afternoon." It's dark. It shouldn't be. The time didn't allow for darkness. But this is a different kind of darkness. And I don't need to explain it to you, I'm sure. The darkness is the light. Jesus is the light of the world, shattering the darkness in this extraordinary way of dying. Virgil, in his Georgics, says, I'm quoting here, "The sun expressed mercy for Rome when Caesar was killed. The sun hid his shining head in gloom, and the impious age feared eternal night." He playing with the same imagery of dark and light. And now to explain that little conundrum about Elijah. So they're the two phrases we've had. My God, why have you forsaken me? And the reaction of the people is, he's calling on Elijah. I want to take you to Psalm 22, the psalm that begins, my God, why have you abandoned me? That's Psalm 22. Why did they choose? Mark did it, Matthew follows. Luke doesn't and John doesn't, but Mark and Matthew do. They choose this to take us to Psalm 22 to try to get the best way they knew to enter into the feeling of what's happening on Calvary. Now in verse 10 of that chapter, and I'm suggesting this only, in fact I've never read it anywhere, but well, it occurred to me a long time ago, so I'll share it with you without expressing there's any value in it, but I think there might be. The 10th verse of that psalm that they chose reads, since my mother bore me, you have been my God. And there's the Hebrew, which you've got to read from right to left. Eli, El, God, E, my God, Ata, you. Very strong language, Hebrew, just very abrupt. You've been my God. Well, what the verse actually says is, my God, you. Eli Ata, that's the English, of course. Now, you'll have to listen to this because I can't go through the whole Hebrew, but there's another expression there in Hebrew, Elia Ta. Elia is Elijah. Ta is come. Now, if you can hear the difference, that's good, but you probably can't. Jesus, if he prayed Psalm 22:10, I suggest it's probably what he did do, because you can't say very much when you're dying of asphyxiation on a cross. If Jesus said, Eli Ata, or did he say, Eliata? No wonder they thought he was calling on Elijah. Just depends where you break the words. And I won't go on about it. But I suggest that perhaps that's what Jesus, they're the words he actually said on the cross. Eli Ata, Eli Ata. My God, you. So he sees God in that moment of dying. The one he loves and the one who's loved him. And he has a vision, or can't find a word for it, but an experience of the intimacy of God. My God, it's you. And if he did, well, that's Psalm 22:10. No wonder they then went back and said, look, and they said, they put the words on Jesus' mouth, my God, why have you abandoned me? They want you to go and read Psalm 22 to get the feel of what was happening on the cross. Another very powerful image. You've probably done this already, but we must learn to read the Gospels. They're much closer to a staged drama than to a diary entry, for God's sake. We're supposed to read it with our hearts. We're supposed to let the music of us hit us and not control the words. Well, look at this. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. I don't remember actually taking this seriously when I was younger, but if I did, I probably thought, oh, well, here's Jesus dying, and 100 yards down the road, there's the temple, and God shows his disapproval of what's happening by miraculously tearing the temple curtain. Once I say it like that, it sounds crazy, surely. What is the temple curtain? What's its purpose? What's its meaning? In the temple itself, you had, it was divided into, there was the inner sanctuary, the, where no one was allowed to go, except the high priest went there once a year on the feast of Yom Kippur. And even then he had to have a whole new set of vestments, he had to bathe for 40 days, he had to do a whole lot of things purifying, because he was going to go behind the curtain temple into the place, and all that's in there is the Ark of the Covenant and the Hilasterion, the mercy seat, which is God's throne. And then there's space and two cherubim, one at this end and one at that end, and their wings were just, and there was that tiniest space in between them. And their faith, that's obviously good liturgy, their faith was that God, that's where God dwells. You can't see God, of course. You can't put a statue of him, of course. But he's present there mysteriously. So no one was allowed into that. You couldn't go in and live, was the way they had thought of it. The high priest, with great protection, went in once a year, yes. Well, if the curtain is torn, there's nothing stopping us seeing, inverted commas, the face of God. That's how they give the expression all the time. They want to see God's face. They want to be in God's presence. Well, you can't, I'm sorry, because you're too sinful. You know, as they say. So they've got this curtain to stop you seeing the face of God. Well, the curtain that was torn on Calvary was got nothing to do with the temple, though symbolically that's what I've tried to share with you. The curtain is that which stops us seeing the face of God in Jesus. Now anyone can see the face of God. There's no curtain, there's nothing blocking you from seeing God by looking at Jesus. And looking at Jesus at this at this amazing moment of his giving his life and his seeing God. And we gaze on Jesus who's seeing God, and so we see God reflected in Jesus' eyes and smile and face and love-giving and yielding up of his spirit. So it's a most powerful line. And I'm wondering why I wasn't taught that when I was a child. I'm not blaming anybody, of course, but we did read the Gospels too literally or something, or maybe as a child that's how you read everything, and maybe that's true. But we're adults. We've lived and loved and been hurt, and so we've got to bring all that to bear when we read the Gospels. Here's Hans Urs von Balthasar again. The one who embraces the cross is always alone, looking up at one who is not looking down, but who is in turn looking up towards God, who seems to have forsaken them both. Jesus is looking up to God. Why have you abandoned me? We're looking at Jesus, who is abandoned or seems to be by God. So that's what's happening when you embrace any cross. He shares our feeling of being abandoned, and he offers us himself, with himself, that's Jesus, of course, to the Father. Those words he spoke, that the Father should forgive them, that his soul is commended to God, that his companion in death should share paradise with him, that our mother is his mother, that he thirsts, that truly all has been accomplished, and these are taken from different Gospels and sayings of Jesus on the cross, those words have meaning only because he knows what it feels like to be abandoned and to continue to trust. Many stand around, some with magnificent gesture, some alert, waiting, speculating, all sensing that something may happen yet which concerns them. Because there is one unanswered question here on Calvary. Is God ultimately revealed? If yes, it must be God's love that makes Jesus cry out with us to the one he cannot see. But why? Why have you forsaken me? We're crying. Jesus is crying. And then this beautiful ending of, let that be God's question to you. Maybe God hasn't forsaken me, but Jesus is saying to me, well, maybe you've forsaken. And then a bit of drama, which Matthew loves. Images taken out of the Old Testament, of course. The earth shook, rocks were split, tombs were opened, many bodies of the saints who'd fallen asleep were raised. After his resurrection, they came out of the tombs and entered the holy city and appeared to many. Well, thank you, Matthew. That's pretty good drama. Interesting that none of the other Gospels mention that. And if you take it literally, it sounds totally unlikely. It does to me anyhow. But he's trying to say something. The associates of drama. This is the music and the stuff to get it across to us how important it is. The association of earthquake with mighty acts of God is traditional. I've got a dozen texts there, and I could give you 100 more. The opening of tombs and the raising of the dead recalls the words of Ezekiel. And I quote, thus says the Lord God, I'm going to open your graves and bring you up from your graves. O my people, I will bring you back to the land of Israel, and you shall know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up from your graves, O my people. So in a short sentence or so, Matthew's trying to show us the significance of Jesus' death. It opens the graves. We say it in the Creed. He descended into hell. Not such a good translation, because the actual text is we descended into Hades, not hell, not Gehenna, but the underworld. What Jesus is doing on the cross is for everybody. In the future, but in the past as well. It's no one, the dead included, are outside God's love demonstrated by Jesus. Matthew is demonstrating the significance of Jesus' death by appealing to symbolic apocalyptic imagery. At the end of his prologue, Matthew quoted from Isaiah chapter 4, the people who sat in darkness, and we're meant to think of all the people who've died from Adam, as it were, on, sitting in darkness. They've seen a great light. And for those who sat in the region and shadow of death, Hades, light has dawned. At Jesus' death, the gates of Hades are opened. Life penetrates the darkness of death, bringing life to those who died in holiness. Since Jesus is the firstborn from the dead, to quote Colossians, and it's right through the New Testament, Matthew adds that it was after Jesus' resurrection that these saints appeared. Now, continues Matthew, when the centurion and those with him who were keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake and what took place, they were terrified and said, truly, this man was God's son. Matthew's drama doesn't appeal to me a lot. It may not appeal to you. It obviously meant a lot to his contemporaries, or he wouldn't have written it like that. And he goes on to tell us, many women were there also looking on from a distance. They'd followed Jesus from Galilee and they'd provided for him, served him. The verb from diakonia, ministry to him. Among them, and he mentions three, there's many more, but these are three significant for Matthew's community. There's Mary Magdalene. There's another Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. And you might recall back in 13, you would recall when Jesus went to Nazareth. That's what they said. Aren't his brothers here, James and Joseph? And then they added Jude, Simon and Jude. They're the ones he's talking about here, two of them, James and Joseph. That's Mary. It's clearly not the Mary, the mother of Jesus, or he would have said so. Mary, that mother, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee, James and John. So there's three women there, Matthew, Mark, Luke. They actually don't mention Jesus' mother being there. Just fact, I'll leave it with you. It's John that has the mother there, as you know. Now in Mark's gospel, which is the basis of all this, he writes, there were also women looking on from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, here we've heard that, Mary, the mother of James, the younger, and Joseph, whatever. And the third one is Salome. So presumably Salome is the mother of the sons of Zebedee, Zebedee's wife. These used to follow him and provide for him when he was in Galilee. And there were many other women who'd come up with him to Jerusalem. Luke has all his acquaintances, including the women who'd followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance. This is much more likely than the way we've been. They wouldn't allow, a man's been crucified on the hill, or the army isn't not going to allow anybody to be standing there, so they're necessarily at a distance. At a distance physically, but not truly at a distance, because they're close to Jesus. Anyhow, Luke says they're at a distance, and that includes all his acquaintances. Presumably Peter, Andrew, and James, and John, and so on, as well as the women. They're watching, and he mentions them. Mary Magdalene, Joanna, it's not mentioned elsewhere, but Luke, whoever Joanna was, and Mary, the mother of James, and the other women with them. John has, standing near the cross of Jesus, were his mother, his mother's sister, and Mary, the wife of Clopas. Sounds like she's the mother of James and Joseph, etc., etc. And Mary Magdalene. So they name different. You've got the picture. When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate ordered it to be given to him. So Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and laid it in his own new tomb, which he'd hewn in the rock. He then rolled a great stone to the door of the tomb, and he went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, were there sitting opposite the tomb. Joseph Arimathea, is willing to stand apart from the other members of the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin. In burying Jesus' body, he incurs ritual defilement. He won't be able to celebrate the Passover. He's waited expectantly for the kingdom of God, and he's seen it in the self-giving love of the servant Messiah. He chooses to risk everything to go with Jesus. He's a symbol for all those of Jesus' own people who would recognize Jesus as their Messiah. The Sabbath is beginning, the day on which God rests, having completed his creating in the story. We have a foretaste of the new creation in Jesus' preaching and his healing ministry. Now, as the women prepare the spices for a proper ritual burial, we wait in silence, wondering what the dawning of a new day will reveal. So they have to get Jesus buried before sunset on Friday. It was in the middle of the afternoon that he cried out, etc. So he died quite quickly. And when you read the story of the way he was treated by the Roman soldiers, you know, it's amazing that he survived. But he wasn't strong enough to carry the cross, so he was nearly dead when he started. They treated him so badly. So here we are on Friday. They've hurriedly buried Jesus, but not properly. Burials are important in all cultures. So the women are going to prepare the spices, and they're going to come back as soon as they can when the Sabbath's over, so for us, Sunday morning, and anoint the body properly and go through all the rituals. If you read John's Gospel, by the way, it's so different. Jesus is anointed then and there, not on the waiting on the Sunday, and he's anointed with enough anointment for a Pharaoh. Like, it's just so dramatically powerful. Because John is telling us who Jesus is. He's not giving us the facts. And when the women come on Sunday morning, they're not coming with spices to anoint him. He's already been anointed. But in Matthew, Mark and Luke, they're bringing their spices to anoint him. So I hope you can see, we're not talking about arguing about what the facts were. We're being taken into the text to see its massive meaning and beauty and so on. And now this is only in Matthew 2, so presumably this is one of the folklore things that came down in the Judean community and found its way up to Antioch. It's not in Luke, it's not in John, it's not in Mark, in Rome, writing in Rome. But we've got some kind of a tradition. I don't know what value to give it. I suspect you wouldn't give it too much value as a fact, but maybe we can read it deeply. The next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember what that impostor said while he was still alive. After 3 days, I'll rise again." Problem. If this is the day after the day of preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees wouldn't be allowed to go anywhere. The Sabbath rest. They wouldn't have gone anywhere near Pilate. So there's a few things here that make us realise we're not actually getting straight data for history here. Anyhow, they said to Pilate, "Command the tomb to be made secure till the third day." Here we have this text again. "Otherwise the disciples may go and steal him away and tell the people he's been raised from the dead, and then the last deception will be worse than the first." Well, of course, that's what they did say. He's raised from the dead. Pilate said to them, "You have a guard of soldiers. We'll go and make as secure as you can." So they went with the guard, made the tomb secure by sealing the stone. I don't know if any of that's historical, but it may be. Then comes Matthew chapter 28, the resurrection narrative. Jesus' death marked for him, as it does for all of us, the end of the only kind of existence of which we human beings have direct sensory experience. This is all we know. It's all we experience. A body like this, death, is the end of all that. We don't see the dead again. Not like this. From the beginning of recorded time, however, we find in the human race an expectation that death marks a horizon. So we can't see beyond the horizon, but it's not the end of existence. And go to Egypt now, look at all the stuff that you know so well about the mummies and all. That's okay. So there's other cultures as well, have this sense that life somehow goes beyond, even though we don't experience it. We've already seen that there was a difference of opinion among Jesus' contemporaries concerning death after death. The Sadducees poo-pooed the whole idea. The Pharisees were in favour of it from their reflections. Jesus himself, we know, and we've seen this, he believed that beyond the grave we would experience life. Not just a wispy existence down in the Sheol or Hades. Life meaning communion with God, because that's what life is. That's the life the rich young man wanted. Any other life comes to an end. But life meaning our communion with God, no. His belief, Jesus' belief, was based on the conviction he had about God, who, having given life, would not withdraw it. And that's what he says to the Sadducees. You don't understand the scriptures and you don't understand the power of God. The fierce opposition which Jesus encountered led him to warn his followers of the death that was surely awaiting him in Jerusalem. Calling it death is wrong, of course, but that's the word we'll use. Because Jesus never died. He said to us too, if you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you'll never die. Yes, this will break down, and then we get into the normal language, but it's not death. However, he didn't fail to share with them also his trust in God would raise him to life, and we've done this, on the third day. God would reveal God beyond all our experience and expectations and philosophies and the rest of us. That's what Jesus trusted. Jesus was indeed raised to life by God, is at the very centre of Christian belief. It's not meant to take us away from the present moment. It's not meant for us to live in an airy-fairy existence of hope that one day... It's not about that, but it's a truth that God is faithful, that life goes beyond what we call death. The whole of the New Testament makes that point. I don't need to make it. Paul's also clear. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, maybe it's the best thing said about heaven in the scriptures. Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has it entered the human heart. We can't conceive of this, what God has prepared for those who love God. Having stressed the belief in the resurrection of Jesus, and so belief that this is what God has in store for us, it's essential to Christian belief, Paul goes on in his first letter to the Corinthians chapter 15 to write. Someone will ask, he writes, how are the dead raised? What kind of body do they have? It's totally natural that we would ponder this. Anyhow, Paul doesn't give us too much time to ponder it. He says, what a foolish question. What kind of body are they going to have, are we going to have when we're raised to life? Some people still think of it as something like this. What a foolish question, says Paul. What you sow doesn't come to life unless it dies. That was their understanding of seed and all that. As for what you sow, you don't sow the body that is to be. You sow a little tiny thing like that and you end up with a great big tree. Doesn't look anything like that little seed. So God gives a body as he's chosen, and to each kind of seed has its own body. So it is with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown, that's what we see. This is what we know. What is sown is in dishonour. Don't want to overdo that. But it's raised in glory. What is sown in weakness, that's us, is raised in power. And then perhaps the most insightful, in Paul's struggling to find words, of course, what is sown is a physical body. What is raised is a spiritual body, a body related to the spirit, life, God, breath, not this one. And Paul doesn't know what it looks like or doesn't try to imagine it even, but he's saying, don't think of the risen body as looking a bit like this one. That's just as silly as looking at a little seed and not recognizing the tree because you're too expecting it's going to look like a seed. When we read the accounts of the post-resurrection experiences of Jesus' disciples, we're not reading descriptions of events. Rather, we're reading dramatic accounts of experiences, accounts which include the meaning these experiences had for Jesus' disciples and the meaning that these experiences came to have in the life of the Christian communities. All the way through the gospel, we're trying to work out what are the photographic facts and what are the dramatic expansions of it to get to meaning. We're doing that all the time. The first two chapters of Matthew we saw was Midrash, so we weren't doing too much of that there. But likewise, after the resurrection, in all the gospels, they're not events that could have been picked up on a video and then recorded forever. Because they would show the risen body to be like this, but it's not like this. So, what have we got in Matthew? After the Sabbath, at the first day of the week was dawning, it's the earliest they could get up, because the Sabbath's over, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. Suddenly, there was a great earthquake. Again, this is only in Matthew. The others drawing on Mark. There's a great earthquake. An angel of the Lord descending from heaven came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, his clothing as white as snow. For fear of him, the guards shook and became like dead men. Good drama. But the angel said to the women, "Don't be afraid. I know that you're looking for Jesus who was crucified." And the first thing is, this angel means this is an enlightenment. They came to see an insight they got as they come to the tomb. He's not here. He's been raised. As he said, "Come, look at the place where he lay. Then go quickly, tell his disciples he's been raised from the dead." And this beautiful line again, it came in the Last Supper, it's going to come again. "He's going ahead of you to Galilee. You'll meet him there." Just as when you finish this retreat today and you go home or wherever you live, you're going to meet the risen Jesus there. in your life. Not that this is not your life, but this is a special moment in your life, so that when you go back to your life, that's where you'll see him. This is my message to you. This enlightenment that they came to when they saw the tomb. So they left the tomb quickly with fear, awe, amazement, and great joy. And they ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly, this is only in Matthew 2, Jesus met them and he said, "Greetings." And they came to him, took hold of his feet. Pause. Uh-oh. Does the risen body have feet? No, that's not what they're saying. This just, they're adoring. This is what you do when you reverence. And they worshipped him. And Jesus said to them, "Don't be afraid. Go and tell my brothers, go to Galilee. They'll see me there." That's Matthew. John, when he writes the same material, he focuses on one woman only, namely Mary of Magdala. And it's a totally beautiful scene. And when does Mary of Magdala see, inverted commas, the risen Jesus? When a stranger calls her by name. "I've called you by your name, you are mine." And she recognizes him in the intimacy that she experiences after his death. Many people experience Jesus like that. We still do. Father Pat O'Carrigan, MSc, who did a lot of these, he spent the last years as an artist, but he spent the last years of his life, he must have done a dozen Stations of the Cross, and that's one of them here. And this is his words, in fact. "The resurrection expresses to the limit paeans of joy, exultations of triumph, the rainbow after sheets of blinding rain, golden sunshine after the gloom, the dance of dawn on the rim of darkness, and the glad sound of all creation singing together. It's the complete orchestration of happiness. Jesus is risen. The tomb could not hold him. He doesn't belong to the world of the dead. He's risen." And then another little thing, only in Matthew, still back to these guards. This is telling you something of the arguments that were going on in the early church. The Jews, who didn't become disciples of Jesus, reckon that, you know, someone stole him and all this, or he wasn't really dead, or there's all these opinions going on. So they dramatise it all, at least Matthew does. "While they were going, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests everything that had happened. After the priests had assembled with the elders, they devised a plan to give a large sum of money to the soldiers, telling them, 'Look, this is what you've got to say. His disciples came by night, stole him away while he was asleep.'" Well, we were asleep. Apparently they were saying that. "If this comes to the governor's ears, we'll satisfy him and we'll keep you out of trouble. Just go and lie your way through this." So they took the money and did as they were told. And the story is still told among the Jews to this day. No doubt that's a fact. He's kind of putting it in his gospel in this way. That's all about the empty tomb. The only scene in Matthew. Mark has no post-resurrection appearances. He ends with the women running away from the tomb, and they said nothing to anyone. They were bewildered. That's the end of his gospel. Later on, people put little summaries of Luke and John and put it like two lines and just to finish off the gospel, make it tidy. But they don't belong to the original gospel of Mark. So he's got nothing to say doesn't try to do it. Matthew has only one scene of the Jesus, the risen Jesus. It's Luke and John that have a number of scenes, Road to Emmaus, you know, and they're basically about the Eucharist. We're going to see the risen Jesus at the Eucharist. That's what they're telling us. But let's go back to Matthew and conclude his gospel. The 11 disciples, because sadly Judas is not there, they did what they were told by Jesus at the Last Supper, actually. They went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. Mountains all the way through Matthew's gospel. The temptations happened on a mountain. The Torah was the new Torah. Sermon on the Mount came on the mountain. The transfiguration happened on a mountain. And so we're back on a mountain again. When they saw Jesus, they worshipped him. But some doubted. Of course. John does this so beautifully. He has Jesus appearing at the Eucharist. And Thomas isn't there. And he has a whole scene of the one who doubted. Thomas. But Matthew just tells us that there was a range of experiences among them. Some doubted. Jesus said to him, "All power in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, God, the Son, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit." The love between Jesus and the Father, which is gifted to everybody. "And teaching them to obey everything I commanded you." John has chapters on that in the Last Supper. "I have one commandment to give you, love one another with my love. And remember," and what a beautiful ending, "I am with you always to the end of the age." Well, Jesus' dream is expressed in that last little scene. He wants the whole world, every single person in it, to come to know that God is love. And he can't do it on his own, of course. He has no hands but yours and mine. So our mission, the mission of the church, is to carry out Jesus' dream.